Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series that focuses on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. In this program, we'll be looking at seeds in New Mexico, from the traditional relationships that people have with seeds to the emergence of the genetically engineered seed crops around the state and the world, and finally to the seed sovereignty movement, which fights to protect traditional seeds from patenting and genetic engineering by large chemical companies such as Monsanto and Cargill. Luis Hina from the Tezuque Pueblo talks about the relationship that people have developed over hundreds of years with seeds.
Seeds are important because our ancestors developed a relationship with plants that allowed their cultivation for food and medicine. And this has been our central element of our culture and our survival for millennia. And the saving seeds, why they're important, is that just as our families are attached to our homes, our seeds learn to thrive in their place of cultivation by developing a relationship with the soil, the water, agricultural practices, ceremonies, and prayers, thereby giving seeds a sacred place in our families and communities. The way in which seeds become attached to a place makes them native seeds, also known as land races, also makes them an important element of the generational memory of our communities.
Esteban Arellano, journalist and traditional farmer, talks a little more about the importance of seeds.
Well, I think the seeds are like the land. They have their own memory, you know. They know how to grow. They know where they'll grow, you know. They know where they come from. That's why when you plant the seed, the memory there of that seed or within that seed tells it how much water it's going to need to grow, how much sunshine, how much cold it'll be able to endure, or heat. You know, that's all part of the genetic code that's embedded in that seed. And if we lose those seeds, we lose a lot of knowledge about the land, about what that seed really represents. You know, we don't think about it. And that's why Monsanto and these corporations are aware of, and they're trying to trademark everything that they can so that they can exploit it and make money. The seeds or animals. Though we do it also every time you plant a seed, it might cross-pollinate with other seeds. We're always also involved in modifying that seed. But we don't do it so drastically that we remove some what the seed has inside from a totally different type of seed or other being and implanting in that particular seed of corn or chili or what it might be.
I spoke with ethnobiologist Miguel Santisteban about the plants that survived a late frost in the early summer.
I mean, even things that I had planted a while ago, they're still not up. Like, it just takes a while for everything to warm up there.
Look,
wow.
Those guys got it.
Dang.
Not all of them got it, but some of them got taken out. And I think that's a function of diversity. You know, like, I don't want those guys anymore. I mean, you know, they didn't handle the frost, but why is it that those ones, you know, took a hit and the guys next door are all right? There must be some genetics to frost tolerance. And that's why we like Alverjón and Habas, because they don't care if it freezes or not. These guys do, you know. Some of the corn, same thing. Look at some of the corn. You know, most of it is all right. So I'm happy with that, you know. But some of it, you can see, like this little guy took a hit. This guy had a hard time right here, you know. But he survived, so that's learning. They're all learning, you know, and that's what's important. It's that they learn how to survive out here, especially with all this stuff that's going on in the world.
Can you explain?
One of the issues that people bring up about seeds developed in laboratories is that they have no genetic memory that protects them from the natural environment and its changes. Another issue that Arellano explained was that with our dependence on supermarkets and the agro-industrial system, we've lost a lot of diversity. He explained that at one point there were over 10,000 varieties of apples, and today we have something like 2,000. The benefit in having such diversity is that if one type of apple falls sick to disease, there are other varieties that can feed us while the disease-ridden tree can recover.
But I think that if we lose our seeds, we're going to lose a lot of the genetic diversity that still exists here in northern New Mexico. It's probably one of the few areas in the country where there's so much diversity, you know, with all the different wild grasses, the corns that are still available in some of the attics and some of the old tin cans that old people have throughout northern New Mexico, in Peñasco, Chamizal, in Embudo, in Cuesta, in San Luis. You know, they have a lot of really valuable genetic stuff there that I hope people don't throw it away, you know. And the same with trees, you know. If you cut a tree, I know that sometimes you have to cut them because you're doing some work there. But what can be done is, like I mentioned a while ago, you know, save some other wood and then graft it into and create a new tree. That way you might get rid of the old tree because it's also dying, but you also save that particular variety of fruit. And that's why I say, you know, some of the things that they might be doing with experimentation in some of the university farms, experimental stations, might be okay, but I think they just can't release them out to everybody and then contaminate all the seeds or tell you, well, you can't use your traditional seeds because you have to buy from me because now I have trademarked that seed that used to belong to your ancestors, to your grandfather, your great-grandfather. Now it's under Monsanto's name, and now if you want to use it, you have... That's one of the things I don't like, you know, that they're forcing you to buy only from them. And once they control all the genetic diversity, then we're screwed, because then if I want to plant some corn to make chicos or pozole, I have to go buy it from them. And they might say, oh, okay, now I'll sell you $10 per seed. And then I won't be able to afford to buy it. Then I have to buy everything from them also, the way they do their own pozole and their own chicos, which would be totally different from the way we do it, because they're going to be doing it for a mass market instead of having a small horno where you might make 10, 15 pounds of chicos. It's going to be done in an oven that might be making 2,000 or 5,000 pounds of corn at one time, you know, and the taste is not going to be the same. So for me, that's the importance of preserving our own seeds, you know. And we trade them. We trade them among the different... My mother always used to trade chili seeds because she said we should always get new chili seed every 5 years and get chili seed that's grown with different waters from different watersheds. She would trade with my aunts that live in the Wicca area, you know, from the seed that was grown there with the water from the Rio Grande, or seed from people that were growing from the Santa Cruz area that were watering with a river from Santa Cruz or from the Rio Chama, you know. People always knew that you could never keep the same seed forever and ever, you know, that you had to exchange it. And if somebody would have some chili that was hotter or less hot or bigger, you know, people would say, well, I like that chili, you know, because not everybody likes chili that's very hot. So they would always be experimenting with different chilies, you know, mixing a little bit of this chili with this chili and planting it and see what it would produce. And it would undoubtedly produce a new variety.
People have a number of problems with genetically modified organisms for a number of reasons, but as far as crops, some of the main concerns are the fact that the seeds have been changed in a way that would not happen in nature, like a fish and corn would never mate. The large chemical companies have developed these seeds that have foreign genes inserted into them, with prescribed traits such as cold tolerance, insect resistance, drug production, or immunity to common pesticides. Large farms use these seeds, in fact. In 2004, two-thirds of the world use of genetically modified crops was by the U.S. Those GMO crops made up 76% of the acreage grown in the nation. The main crops are soybeans, cotton, corn, canola, squash, and papaya. Usage has increased. One of the issues that Ariano brought up was the patenting of GE seeds. Because seeds are developed with biotechnology, the seed is legally no longer able to be saved. There are problems with this as crops are grown in uncontained areas where bees and butterflies don't bother with patenting laws. They share different pollens, or the wind might blow seeds from trucks hauling a farmer's harvest. A technology that the chemical companies are working to patent at the moment is a terminator gene, which will end the life cycle of a seed and protect the large corporations from patenting infringement. Currently, Monsanto has an annual budget of $10 million, employing 75 people whose sole purpose is to investigate and prosecute farmers who they feel have stolen their technology. The courts generally lean in the favor of the large chemical corporations. Because of these issues and the potential for contamination of heirloom and traditionally saved seeds, a number of individuals and groups in northern New Mexico have begun to work with one another and with national and global movements to protect traditional seeds. New Mexico is unique in that there are a number of sovereign nations between the different pueblos and tribes. This is Luis Hina, a farmer from the Tezuque Pueblo. He's worked with the Native American Farmers Association and the New Mexico Acequia Association to educate the state legislature with a memorandum that explains why native seeds should be protected from contamination with genetically engineered crops.
The traditional Native American Farmers Association and the New Mexico Acequia Association began a conversation on ways to protect our seeds. And we came up with a mission statement to continue, revive, and protect our native seeds, crops, heritage fruits, animals, wild plants, traditions, and knowledge of our indigenous land and Acequia-based communities in New Mexico for the purpose of maintaining and continuing our cultural integrity and resisting the global industrialized food system that can corrupt our lives, freedom, and culture through inappropriate food production and genetic engineering. The technology of genetic engineering is largely unregulated and has effects on the natural world that are not clearly understood. The imminent danger of this technology on indigenous communities and agriculture is that the components of traditional ag systems, i.e. seeds, crops, wild plants, and animals, can be corrupted via wind pollination or other means from genetically engineered organisms. This has already happened in the case of maíz in Mexico. This potential occurring locally and elsewhere is a violation of indigenous and land-based peoples' right to continue the seed-saving, seed-sharing, and food traditions that have been central to our survival from time immemorial. Seed sovereignty is a way to protect our common interest in keeping our agricultural systems free of corruption by genetic engineering and from corporations usurping governmental entities. Well, with the state legislature this past spring, we took the seed declaration, and we also took the resolutions from Tezuque, Pewaukee, 8 Northern, and the All Indian Pueblo Councils, and asked for support from both the House and the Senate at the legislature. And both the House and the Senate passed memorials recognizing the significance of indigenous agricultural practices and native seeds to New Mexico's cultural heritage and food security, and support for several objectives, such as protecting native seeds from genetic contamination, increasing the extent of cultivation of native seeds, and raising of small herds of livestock in pueblos and acequia villages, supporting the livelihood of traditional farmers and ranchers with financial educational resources, leading to improved viability of farming, and increasing the extent to which locally grown food is served within the same community in which it is grown, particularly by tribal public and community institutions. Well, like I said, they passed both Senate and House passed the memorials. At about the 11th hour, there was people that came up opposing the memorials, even trying to kill the memorials, which raised a lot of eyebrows within the legislative bodies, and which was good for us. And so we were able to educate the legislative bodies as to what genetically engineering and contamination means to us. You know, some of them, the legislature's constituents are already using GE cotton. They've expressed their concerns as to water usage of the plants and how they support the GE industry. Like I stated earlier, we just need to educate these individuals and hopefully we can change their minds and their practices.
What's been the reaction of the large GE companies to what's going on here?
Well, as soon as they found out, you know, they're the ones that called our Secretary of Ag here in New Mexico, who in turn called some of the legislatures, like stated, to either kill or modify language within the memorials, were able to get other entities to call the legislatures to oppose the memorials. They came out and they have the money. They can do a big ad campaign opposing what we're doing. We're just trying to protect who we are, our way of life.
During this campaign, full-page articles came out promoting the use of genetically modified crops. Letters of support for the seed sovereignty movement also found their ways into papers. Because of these types of local movements banning the use of genetically engineered seeds in communities in California and Arkansas, as well as global movements which require the labeling of GMOs, the Farm Bill of 2007 had, for a short time, a section that would not allow states or communities to ban non-regulates, which referred to the genetically modified organisms. The section was taken out due to public outcry. I spoke to a scientist at New Mexico State University who develops genetically engineered seeds. Her reason for working on this subject was that she wanted to fight world hunger. She wanted to work against drought and blight to help the seed. That's perfect. However, a lot of the problems that the world has with world hunger comes from the World Bank and World Trade programs, which force developing countries to grow cash crops for export to developed countries rather than allowing the countries to grow food for their own people. Miguel Santisteban, ethnobiologist from the New Mexico Acequia Association, explains how seed corporations operate and why the seeds that they produce are such a concern.
Well, world hunger. You know, we want to address world hunger. I don't buy that. Probably some well-intentioned people, but again, they're probably towing the line of the corporations. Like, for example, everyone else talks about Africa. Okay? Why, if all these people and corporations are concerned about world hunger, why is Africa exporting all their agricultural products for the United States? Why are we drinking coffee, you know, 3-4 times a day from Africa when they can't feed themselves? You know, until you address that fundamental question of why don't those people have access to their own resources to feed themselves, then we can't do a technological fix. Well, ever since the Green Revolution, there's all these technologies that came out, and it's interesting that all these technologies that came out for agriculture were actually a result of technologies that came out of war. The pesticides were chemical agents that they were experimenting with, nerve gas to destroy the enemy. The herbicides, you know, derivatives of Agent Orange and napalm. The chemical fertilizers, the same thing. All of these were like military type of technologies. And then all the machinery. But those technologies translated directly over to our food system. So you look at the food system now, and the farmers, earlier I commented I consider myself more of an artist than a farmer or a gardener. But these farmers, they know how much acreage they have, how many seeds they're planting per acre, how much fertilizer they're putting per acre, how many gallons of pesticides, how many gallons of herbicides. That whole environment is not a contained, but that whole environment is a controlled environment with all of these inputs. All of these inputs are coming from external sources, which are directly related to this whole industry, right? So, you know, they're scratching each other's back. But the thing is all of those resources that are required to maintain the agricultural system are dependent on fossil fuels and transportation. So that right there is telling you, oh, well, that's the problem with climate change. Because we're running out of fossil fuels, and the fossil fuels are ending up in the atmosphere and creating, you know, CO2 buildup and all of this stuff. That agricultural system that depends on all of those chemicals, it's almost like it's creating its ecosystem.
its ecosystem is the substrate, which is the soil, is, you know, so many pounds of nitrogen, fertilizer per acre, no weeds because there's herbicides, no so-called pests because there's pesticides, no viruses or fungi because, you know, there's fungicides applied, you know, and the whole thing is contained and managed by machines, even by satellite in some cases. You know, there's not even farmers driving out there. There's satellites that are watching the whole system. You know, they're assuming that they're going to be able to maintain all of those resources, all of those inputs to maintain that system, inevitably. You know, and they're talking about ethanol, and but that's all the same stuff. Ethanol still requires chemical fertilizer, still requires pesticides, still requires fungicide, still requires all this industrial machinery. All that relies on fossil fuel. So what happens when Mother Earth plays her card? She has the ace. What happens when you have every variable controlled in your agricultural system except the climate? There's not a technology out there that's going to stop a tornado, that's going to stop hailstorm, that's going to stop a heat wave, that's going to stop a drought. And they're talking about cloud seeding and all this stuff. But what's going to happen in the Midwest is you're going to see something that's related to climate change. Hailstorm, heat wave, drought, windstorm. And they're not going to be able to adapt to that. The only way that those kinds of things can be adapted to is to have a seed that's smart. Like native seeds that say, oh, drought. Okay, well, half of us aren't going to make it. But half of us, remember, there was a drought in 1880. There was a drought in 1650. Those seeds, remember, you know, the seeds out in the field around here, remember those kinds of things. Oh, hailstorms. Okay, we've seen hailstorms every year. We know that. Our ancestors had all of these problems. But with this industrial food system, not only is the environment completely controlled and technological and dependent on fossil fuels and dependent on transportation and dependent on all these chemical refineries and all of that stuff, but the seeds themselves don't have a memory of a particular landscape, of a particular cultivation method, of a particular environment. All those seeds have a memory of is being manipulated in the lab. They were F1 hybrids. They were inbred for generation upon generation so they could produce a hybrid so that they can then be genetically engineered. That's all those seeds know. There is no way they're going to stand against what's coming. Every seed in a traditional or a native-based agricultural system is an individual who has a memory of all of the environmental factors in the past. I mean, when you're talking about corn, it goes all the way to Mexico. It's likely the corn has a memory of being in Hopi country where there's no water, where it's a hyper desert, because that's the way the corn got over here. But this other way of them doing this industrial food system, it's like a big Jenga block. And all it needs to be is pulled out one block, which is freeze in the middle of July. Oh, that's impossible. A freeze in the middle of July? Hey, try climate change on. We just had a freeze a couple days ago out here. That's unheard of. For it to freeze in the middle of June. When's the last time that has happened? Hardly ever. But we're going to be seeing things like that. And can these crops adapt? And can our agricultural system adapt? Because if I keep farming the way I'm farming, it's not going to work. I'll tell you that right now. Because I just saw what that frost did. And if flat frost was a little bit harder, I would have lost everything. But there's ways to avert that. But it relies on what I do as a farmer, as an artist, as an innovator, as someone with ideas and imagination. See, right now the industrial food system is fed a package. These are the machines you use. These are the chemicals you use. These are the seeds you use. And you're going to produce this much, and we're going to pay you this much. But pretty soon that environmental variable, the climate change variable, is going to max out. And there is no way that industrial food system is going to adapt. It can't. And around here, who knows, you know, what's going to happen. I say right now, we have a lot of land. We have enough water. We don't have enough seed. That's what I'm working on, is growing out seed and getting seed out to people and trying to inspire more local agriculture for seed production, because that's the only thing that's going to pull us through. And if you think you got another idea about how we're going to pull through that, I'll tell you right now, that's a short-term solution. The long-term solution is to maintain the relationship with the plants, with the land, to adapt, to pay attention, to adjust, to select your strongest, your best seed, and keep going. If you're not taking care of the basics, which is food and water, and then fuel for the winter, forget it, man. Solar panels ain't going to save you. You know? None of that's going to save you. The only thing that can save us, I think, is to have these seeds and to cherish them as our most honored members of our family, because they're the reason our family is going to continue. And we used to think like that. And now we don't, because we think that the corporations are going to take care of it. The stores are always going to have food on the shelves. And I tell you, those days are numbered. They're not going to adapt to what's coming. I don't see it happening. And I hope I'm wrong.
Much of the farming in the southeastern part of the state, which accounts for the majority of the state's farming, uses genetically engineered seeds. The people say that GE crops are necessary to compete with the rest of the country, and that the seeds reduce the amount of pesticides used and water used. Other groups question those numbers and have done studies that show that the GMO crops require more water and after time don't yield as much as the earth has been filled with herbicides and pesticides. I asked Santisteban what it means to be New Mexican.
I think it means that you are ready, willing, and able to live here. But it means to really live here, to live from here. See, a lot of people come over here and they say, oh, I want to build my big old house. I want to live here 1 week a year, 2 weeks a year. I want to shop at the organic store and buy apples from New Zealand. And if things don't go right for me, I'm going to complain to the county commissioner, to the town, and I'm going to make everyone bend to my will. No, that's not living here. Living here is how the coyote lives here. The coyote lives here because she is strong. She'll chew through her own leg to get out of the trap. And you'll notice, cockroaches don't live here. Cockroaches can live everywhere, anywhere in this planet, but they don't live here. You know why? Because a coyote will eat them, that's why. This is a hard environment, and you can only live here and be from here if you're that tough. Can you handle a drought? Can you get by on less? Can you adapt? Can you accept whatever nature gives or doesn't give you? And can you work together to get by, knowing that there's always enough? To me, that's what it means to be a Nuevo Mexicano. And you have to be willing to compromise with Mother Nature. Because some years, you're going to get water. And some years, you're not.
Are you ready to live here like Coyote? This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council, in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappet for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.